Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, psychological health, physical health awareness in men, women and society. First, it started with MAN, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. He's very close by. I'm sure we're both very hot because the temperature here is about 41. Introduce yourself.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you, Andrew, for having me on your podcast. I appreciate you reaching out to me. And when it comes to mental health, emotional health, social health, well-being, these things are critically important to me, so I'd like to take any opportunity I can to talk about them. So my name is Andy Vasily. I'm based right now in Saudi Arabia, as you say, quite close to where you are. It's not as hot here. It's probably about 36 or 37 today, but high humidity. I went for my run very early in the morning to avoid the heat. Yeah. So I've been based in Saudi for 5 years. I'm on the leadership team here at the Kaus School, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. My background is physical education and health. I was a competitive athlete. I played American football. That was my first love growing up, and golf, two polar opposites, right, when it comes to sport. But, you know, through sport, I learned a lot in my life, and I found important mentors. I decided to take the coaching route, which inspired me to become a teacher. So I'm from Windsor, Ontario, Canada.
Right.
But I thought that I would stay in my hometown forever, become a teacher there or a police officer and coach football. But as good fortune and luck would have it, my world opened up to me, and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, had an opportunity to go to Japan. And she went to Japan, and I followed in her footsteps and have never been back to Canada since, on vacation. But so I've worked at IB schools, so PYP schools, in Japan, Azerbaijan, Cambodia, China, and now in Saudi. So I stopped teaching in 2014 to take on a consulting role, and then this position at my school here opened up as an instructional coach, a pedagogical coach, on the leadership team, helping to develop teacher practice. And it's something I'm very passionate about. So in a nutshell, that's who I am and what I do.
Yeah. And I done a webinar a couple of days ago, and it was a couple of days ago. And I was telling you earlier how I got hold of you is someone said that you're very, very inspirational. And I can see why. I mean, you've done a lot. You've done so many things. And obviously you're on a path, maybe on that kind of path to help people. For the listeners out there, tell them where, for people who may, listen to the podcast all over the world, where is Saudi Arabia? What's it like to live there? And, what's it like at the moment?
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, smack dab in Middle East. Don't know my geography that well, but I think it's south, kind of southwest of where you are. I never thought I'd end up in a place like this, but one of the things I've learned in life through my experiences is to be very open-minded. And never thought I would end up here, but had the opportunity to come to this amazing school in Saudi Arabia is truly changing. It's been amazing just in 5 years here, seeing the country open its doors to tourism. Women can drive. Women are feeling more and more empowered in the country. They're supported in many ways to pursue their own interests. So it's not the Saudi Arabia that I once heard about. And I've developed friendships with lots of Saudis here at the school. They're wonderful people. They care deeply for what they do in education. So it's been an outstanding experience. I have two boys, one 17, one 15. They both go to the high school. They're thriving here. And my wife is also working at the school. So I have nothing but really a lot of gratitude for having the opportunity to come here and experience a part of the world that very few people can experience.
Yeah. And Saudi, like here, is obviously a Muslim country. And how long do you say you've been there?
5 years.
5 years. So have you seen changes? Because I know, like you said, there seems to be, in the last, I would say, from looking from the outside in, there seems to be the changes are coming quickly, like being ramped up. They're trying to get things like boxing there. You've got the heavyweight championships of the world and things like that, and they're trying to get other sports there. How are you finding those changes in the last 5 years?
Yeah, amazing. Like, we've been to amazing soccer matches, football matches, Brazil. I think we saw Brazil versus Argentina a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
As you say, the boxing, UFC is now here. Golf is a passion of mine. The golf course is just around the corner. I just finished my captaincy, so I was captain of the club for a couple years. So golf is really taking off here, and the European Golf Tour signed a deal to have the first golf event ever in Saudi.
Yeah.
So we just had our third tournament here, and we volunteer. My son and I volunteer, as well as many people from the school volunteer at the tournament, see world-class players. So it really is opening up, and I don't want to say, like, out of respect for the culture and the religion and the people, they are devout Muslims, and at one time it was very traditional, very regimented, very strict laws, and those have loosened up greatly.
Yeah.
The fact that tourism is now opened up, people, they welcome tourists, and there are some stunning places that you can visit here. When you go to the shopping malls, it's like being at any shopping mall around the world.
Yeah.
So everybody's, you know, helpful, and you just see families running around. It's like a normal place, really, to be honest.
Yeah, so things are really opening up and changing, and
you've
been there noticing a lot of changes and things like that. And obviously, once the doors open up for tourism and flights coming in and then people, you know, it will, once they start to, you know, to understand that the tourism industry brings in other avenues, like you say, the sports, which is obviously a big factor. And as we know, here, this region's got, Qatar's got the World Cup. So that would be a big factor for the Asian community. And I'm sure they're coming here. I'm sure Saudi Arabia are coming here for the Asian Cup in December for football. So
yeah,
it should be a big tournament here.
Yeah.
How have you found the last year then? Let's talk about... let's talk about this what's happened in the last year, and how have you found it living there?
So the last year, more than a year now, obviously it's been a challenge for everybody. For our school, we, like every other school around the world, we have our own context here. We tried our best to keep business running as normal, but it's difficult to do that. You have to pivot and adjust, and you have to be flexible. What I've noticed is, mental health is critical right now. It's critically important. Teachers are struggling, but they're also very innovative and very committed to what they do, and they are pushing on the best that they can. So over the last year, you know, with the lockdown here, we were in lockdown for probably, I think, maybe 3 months. Distance learning during that time, it was at the end of last school year. That was a struggle for a lot of people. For me personally, I've suffered from depression in the past. So I've had to learn to, I didn't know it was depression at the time, but over the years, I just knew that there was a feeling that I would get at certain times of year. And I just would push on. I'm very physically active, and that always helped me when I was running and working out, playing sport. So I always knew that that was important to me. So when lockdown happened, I felt fine. I was getting some exercise. We could go out for exercise a little bit every day.
Yeah.
So I was getting my exercise in, but I still felt that feeling coming on. So I knew that I had to address it straight on. And I did some hard work, internal work, to better understand it and to be non-judgmental about it, not beat myself up over it. And to know that it's important to deal with these things straight on. So it didn't hold me back from doing my job. But what it did do was just cause greater levels of anxiety that I just had to kind of suppress. I'm just shutting off my ringer here. So yeah, it was a bit of a struggle, to be honest, and I just I dealt with it the best way that I could and continued to move forward and connect with others and have conversations about it. So I think I'm not the only one who's, you know, struggled during this time. The most important thing is just to address it and to be non-judgmental through the process.
Yeah. And how were things in terms of the country? You know, you said it was restricted. And when it opened back up, what was that like to kind of, because I'm finding that obviously mental health, people are struggling because of, it's not something that, this is something that we've never seen before, and not probably not in our lifetime or whatever. And it's for some people who maybe who used to being on their own, it's probably not new to them. But for people around in Saudi Arabia, what was the kind of like the atmosphere like?
I think it was a matter of understanding that the world is going through it, and to not compare ourselves to what other places are going to because they have a different context. But I think that for the most part, everybody was trying to figure it out on their own, and having conversations with other people. And it was useless to have a conversation about wishing this would end or when is this going to end, but more importantly, to discuss what needed to be done now to take care of ourselves and to take care of our students and to be a support network for one another. And then shift the conversations away from, I wish this wasn't happening, this sucks, why did this have to happen, when is it gonna end, to what am I in control of and what do I need to do to better serve myself and serve others. And to figure that out and to connect with people, because there were still a lot of people that just tried to press on, and you'd ask how they're doing and they'd say, living the dream, living the dream. They just didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And you know that's bullshit. They're not living the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
They're struggling too. So I did call out a couple of my friends that use that phrase a lot. Oh, I'm living the dream. All is good. And I said, you know what? I want you to stop saying that to me. Because I'm genuinely asking how you're doing, and I know that your answer is not genuine.
Yeah.
And that your answer is telling me that you're not in a position to truly tell me how you're feeling.
Yeah.
So when you want to have a conversation with me on the side and really let me know how you're doing, then let's do that. But I ask you not to respond to my question, how are you doing, in that way, because I know that's not the case.
Yeah.
So it was some honest discussions as well, you know, not confrontational, just honest, supportive discussions that then really needed to be had at certain times.
Yeah. And how were things back, you know, from Canada? How were things happening? What was actually happening there? Did you see a direct comparison, or was it different things happening?
Yeah, it was different context, really. You know, I spoke with friends back there, and, you know, you're trying to keep track of, is your school back open or is your business open? And then questions are just, everybody's experiencing something different, you know? So I think everybody was going through their thing back there, and they're worried about themselves and their family, and they're trying to figure it out. So I guess I return back to, everybody has a very unique personal narrative.
Yeah.
Everybody has a very unique life perspective, and everybody's so different through all of this, yet we struggle from the same things. So yeah, I guess I found that I was having some conversations with friends back home, and they were just trying to figure it out themselves. So everybody's concerned with just trying to figure it out. And for those of us in schools that still have jobs, great, but there's a lot of people back home who lost their jobs. I have friends that had businesses that the businesses didn't go bankrupt, but pretty close to going bankrupt.
Yeah.
So they're trying to figure it out. So yeah, it's just, it's a struggle for everybody, and it's a different context for everybody. That's what I found through it all.
Yeah. And as I say to you as well, the in terms of, I was going to ask you about being a, you know, how do you see, this is just more in a kind of, almost like on a personal level in a sense, how do you see, does Saudi Arabia see PET? I know they're moving into sports now, and you know, around this area, but how do you think that they see PE teachers? I mean, is it a job that is, because I know academics has taken a front foot in the last, we'll say last, definitely in the last year, because obviously a lot of schooling's been lost, and PE kind of taken a backbone. I mean, I don't know how, what was your feeling about that?
Well, I think there's a distinct difference between international schools and local schools.
Yeah.
First of all, right? So international schools have a much different, a very different approach to physical education and sport, whereas local schools have a very different approach. And I've worked in Azerbaijan, where you have local Azeri schools that are very much skill and drill and fitness and sport, whereas the international school was very much inquiry-based teaching and learning and autonomy and choice. And so I think I've met a couple local Saudi PE teachers, not from our compound here. And I think that's the way it is locally. Like they tend to gravitate towards soccer and some of these team sports, and there's not so much about individual pursuits and these other types of experiences that I feel should be developed.
Yeah.
So it's, again, it's contextual for the culture and the local schools. And I've taught in Japan, and the international school, again, very inquiry-based teaching and learning, whereas the local schools in Japan and China were very much skill and drill and teacher compliance, control and compliance, and just a different way to teach, you know. So I think there's a distinct difference between local schools and international schools, for sure.
Yeah. And so let's talk about you. I mean, we've talked about the because in fact one more thing as well I was going to ask you about. Do the locals see mental health there as if we ignore the last year and the pandemic and all that, have you noticed there's anything available for people that may be struggling with mental health, or is it kind of like something that's hidden, or is it a new thing for them?
I think there's starting to be a bit of a shift towards more of a focus on mental health.
Yeah.
Whether you're a female or a male who's struggling, I think there's a little more of a shift, but this is not just a Saudi thing. I think it's a Middle East thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's an Asia thing, you know, where it's still very much suppressed and under the surface, and just starting to rise above and to be, you know, that it's starting to become just a little more prevalent, that people are willing to acknowledge that mental health is very important.
Yeah.
So I think Middle East, Asia, even Eastern Europe, it's more suppressed, but it's starting to just rise above a little bit and to start to become a little more okay to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm definitely going to presume that with what's happened in the last year, that it's going to that conversation is going to be had a lot more now, because of what the impact of this. So it could be the impact of somebody who's died in the family, or it could be a child who's struggling at school or whatever. I think there's going to be a lot more conversation around mental health. And I was on a panel last year, last year, to do with World Mental Health Day, and it was loads of, you know, there's Qataris on it, there's people from different walks of life and professional people, and it was very interesting to hear them, and kind of like you say, it's kind of bubbling on the surface and now it's coming forward. So
yeah.
I always think that mental health is, you know, when we struggle, I think it's something that it should be treated as same way as a broken leg. We shouldn't, do you see what I mean? We shouldn't we shouldn't, like you said, your microphone's broken. Do you see what I mean?
Our
mental health, it should be a thing where it's not papering over the crack. We try and fix it, and it should be a thing where we can walk into somewhere and talk to somebody and open up. And I think that's going to take, it's going to take time. It's happening in other parts of the world. So let's talk about your journey. Your journey, and to the person that you've become now, and to what you've, you know, you're being an inspirer of people. And I can hear that, because you're obviously a person that wants to help people. And I see, and when you pointed the finger and the finger wagging, then I knew that you're a person that was letting the person know, no, if you want to talk to me, open up and talk to me, rather than saying, you know, what you're going to say. Rather than this one line saying that all the time, no, talk to me. So I can see that you're a person that wants to help. Let's talk about your journey and your, you know, start to beginning. What's life like for you as a child growing up?
Good question. So I grew up in I did a TED talk. I was very lucky to be invited to give a TEDx talk. And at first I was going to do the talk around my passion for education and my passion for physical activity and sport and what physical activity and sport meant to me. But I knew that was a very safe topic because I can talk forever about sport and physical activity and the impact it has on people. But the real challenge was for me to take the opportunity to be on the TED stage and to share my authentic self. And it was scary. And I knew that I had to share something was pushing me to share my truth, which is I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. There's a lot of mental illness, addiction, depression. Yeah. My mother was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic, but he was more of a quiet drinker, very kind, you know, just kind of kept to himself. But it was a very volatile environment growing up. And I had three older brothers and an older sister. And I was the youngest. So I was able to kind of, as I say, I found physical activity and sport, and that got me out the door in the morning.
Yeah.
And that led to me having a specific purpose. So whether it be riding a bicycle or climbing trees or playing road hockey, skating out on the lake when it froze in the winter, playing basketball, I explored all these forms of movement and then ultimately fell in love with American football.
Yeah.
By literally going to the library and going through the bookshelf in the library, then I found a book about the Heisman Trophy. The Heisman Trophy Award is an award that goes out to the top college football player in the U.S. every year.
Yeah.
So I got this book and I started to read these inspiring stories about football, and then I fell in love with the sport. And that was probably when I was 11 years old to maybe 10 years old. From the time I was 10 to 24, I had a football in my hand every single day. Yeah. And that really got me out the door. I taught myself how to throw. So I was a quarterback and a punter. So I taught myself how to kick the football, how to throw the football. That led to me playing high school football. Then I played in a travel league after high school. And then I ultimately played 5 years at my university. I was team captain, met wonderful people there. And I returned back to sport, football in particular, just giving me that purpose and meaning in my life that steered me away from drugs, steered me away from all the shit going on with my family.
Yeah.
And I, even though I was sucked into that scene at times, I was able to extract myself.
Yeah.
And I never missed one practice ever, because that was my saving grace. That was where I wanted to be. That's where I felt valued. That's where I felt seen. That's where I felt I belonged. And in the process, meeting these wonderful teammates who are still good friends to this day, and meeting a lot of coaches who mentored me. And then I knew for certain that I wanted to give back and I wanted to connect with youth. And I ended up going back to my old high school, and I was the head coach of my high school football team as I was playing for the university. And I recruited a bunch of my teammates to coach the team. And it was such a rewarding experience. And I didn't understand the impact that sport had until later in my life. And in 1999, I lost my one brother to drug addiction about a week before Christmas. Right. I was living in Japan at the time, and he had an aneurysm that was brought on by drug addiction. Yeah. So I wasn't able, there were no flights back to Canada. I wasn't able to go to his funeral. So that was kind of an awakening where I realized that, wow, something was different about my life, and the things that I did led me away from that. So I was still trying to figure it out. I was living in Japan at the time, still super active, running a lot of races, playing American football for the team in the city that I lived in, and, you know, having these wonderful opportunities to teach at an international school and to coach. And then I moved to the next school, then the next school. And when I was living in China, my other brother committed suicide. So he suffered from major depression. And again, that was one of those moments in my life where I had to deeply reflect on what it was. Like, I'm not a religious person, but I'm very spiritual. Yeah. And I had to reflect on what it was that God gave me that he didn't give my brothers. Why was it that my brothers fell victim to drugs and addiction and depression? And what was it about my journey that allowed me to steer clear of those things? Not clear of the depression, but to more or less move in a different direction. Yeah. And I realized it was physical activity and sport. And that's when I started to put the pieces together. Yeah. And I realized that it was actually changing the my brain's neurobiology and the neurochemistry of my brain, and it was giving me this hope that my brothers didn't have. So I started to piece together the kind of the pieces of the puzzle, and then that led to me thinking about, well, how can I have the greatest impact possible on student learning in phys ed, and how can I create these experiences for students that are deeply meaningful? Well, first of all, I have to remove myself from the formula. It's not about me. It's not about what I think they need to learn. It's about creating the conditions for them to explore and to be inspired, and to find, even if they find one way to be inspired through movement, I've done my job. So it wasn't about me making them into basketball players or soccer, football players or track and field stars. It was about me showing them what was possible in regards to physical activity and sports. So that really opened the door for me to deeply think about my own pedagogical practice and to really figure out how I can create these conditions. So that's when my teaching kind of shifted, and I really started to focus on the factors necessary to intrinsically motivate my students. And then that led me to connect to researchers and to ultimately become a researcher of my own practice, and to develop a framework that I knew worked, but it was based on a hunch. Yeah. Once I started to do my own research, then I was realizing I am having an impact here. So how can I take this forward? And then God opened the door to me again and gave me an opportunity to become a consultant and to go around the world to speak in different countries and to share my practice. Not saying that I knew best, but just to share my practice and saying, this has worked for me. Take these ideas, modify them, try them out. And then I had a lot of success with that, and a lot of schools started to implement this framework. And so that's kind of my journey of figuring stuff out and to deeply reflect on myself and what I went through in my life. And, you know, the death, the addiction, the depression, and to somehow figure out my own purpose. And that's what it's been about.
Yeah, so let's talk about your from 0 to 11 to the point where you looked for that book. Look for that, because when you said to, you know, about children looking for, or young people, children, about if they could find that one thing, it's almost like it's almost like you're putting what you have found for yourself, which was that one thing, because you emphasize that one thing. And I thought to myself, oh, he's what he's doing there, he's actually found that one thing himself, which was the American football, which kind of got you out and helped you. You spoke about it being, your parents were alcoholic and your dad, and then you spoke about you teaching yourself. Because quite often, I know American football, and I know, well, any sport, football in England, the dads and the boys go out and play football, or, I know in America, they have the, one of the first things they have on is a mitt, or in Canada, it may be, whatever it may be. Do you have a male role model? Do you see him as a male model, or you didn't have that one?
My dad was an athlete in high school, so he would come out and throw the football around with me, and he had a pretty good arm, and he told me about his high school football playing days, and he would be there sporadically, 15-20 minutes, and he would go inside, but that was enough to make a connection with him, and he also was the one who taught me how to golf. So he was there. I wouldn't necessarily classify him as a mentor, but he was somebody that I treasured spending time with when he was playing sport with me. But it was my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, who was really the disciplinarian, who kind of helped me stay on track as well. And he's Japanese Canadian, born in Canada but of Japanese descent, so he grew up very disciplined in a very Asian traditional household, very disciplined, studied martial arts, got his black belt, very driven in his life, did amazing things. So he was very hard on me to the point that I feared him, but he also cared deeply for me. And again, like, we're still, he's like my brother, he's my brother-in-law, but I consider him to be kind of like a father figure, a best friend and a brother. So I had him, and he really taught me the value of when I say being tough, playing football, I needed to be tough. I needed to be strong. I was undersized. I needed to really work out and put on weight and to be strong. So he taught me that side of it, and I needed somebody to push me there. But he was quite strict sometimes, but that's what I needed at the time. So he was definitely a mentor in my life.
Did you join that from 0 to 11, did you, to the point where you found the book, would you say then there were times where you're looking to escape from all the things that have happened, all the things that were happening in your house?
Absolutely, 100%. And I lived in a small rural town, so there was no football where I grew up, so I was one of the only kids in the neighborhood that played it, and so I would teach the other kids in the neighborhood how to play it, and then we would play games. And so I, when I say I taught myself, I truly taught myself. So I read the books and I learned how to throw and learned how to kick, and then we moved to a big city when I was in grade 9, so suddenly I was on the football team for the high school, not knowing what the hell was going on. I was just like, suddenly I was wearing equipment for the first time and feeling very intimidated, but quickly found my rhythm and pace and my specialty, which was throwing and kicking, and I always fulfilled those positions on the team. So I didn't really start playing as a starter till later in high school, but yeah, it was something that, come from this small town, and suddenly I'm playing high school in a city with, these big players who played their whole life proper football. So yeah, that was a really cool experience.
So as a child, did you ever kind of feel a sort of, not dread, but of not want, I don't know if you can ever think back to that, but not wanting to go back into the house? You'd probably spend all day playing or whatever, and you dread to go back into the house because of what might happen.
Yeah, there were times like where I stayed out as late as possible, or I'd go in and we didn't have family dinners. We only had family dinners once a week, so more or less, like, a meal would be made and you'd come in and you'd quickly eat and do your own thing. But being the youngest, I could just kind of disappear. It was easy for me. to not be seen, you know, and to disappear into my own little world. I'd go up in my room, whatever it was. But I was able to disappear and just not be seen. And that really helped me as well, where I think my older brothers obviously took the brunt of you know, the alcoholism, and my mom suffered from anxiety and depression, and you know, she did her best, and I understand that, but they took the brunt of it, you know, so I was able to kind of just stay to myself and find my own way and just kind of disappear, you know.
How much older were they? How much older were your brothers?
6 years. The next one was 6 years older, then 8 years, and my sister was seven, 8, 9 years older. My two brothers and my sister, and then the oldest brother was 12 years older than me.
Yeah, so they would.
So he was out of the house by the time I was 6 or 7.
Yeah, so some of them would have seen what was going off at the early stages and grown with it, whereas you're the youngest and you're kind of growing, you're seeing the kind of, not, I won't say the tail end, but you're seeing the other side, even though it might have been volatile, and that you're seeing that, but they would have seen a lot more to it, and then you know, maybe not found ways to kind of cope with what's
exactly
happening. So how did you look up to? Did you ever look up to your brothers? I mean, were you kind of close?
Yeah. They were professional musicians. Two of them were phenomenal musicians. Yeah. My one brother, who died of a drug aneurysm, was a phenomenal guitarist, and he was incredibly talented when it came to woodworking. So he had his own woodworking business by the time he was 21, and then he played guitar in lots of different bands. My oldest brother played bass guitar, so those two formed a band that was quite well known. The one year they had like the number one video in Canada. And my brother, who played guitar, built custom made guitars for some of Canada's top rock bands. Yeah. So I really looked up to him. He taught me how to play guitar. So I spent a lot of time watching them perform music, and so I really did look up to them, and they were incredibly talented. And then as they moved older and older into their 20s, that's when they really started to struggle. And really, you know, my brother, who played guitar, the oldest brother played bass. He never touched drugs. He barely drank. And the brother next to me that played guitar, the one 6 years older than me, he would drink a little bit, never touch drugs, and then suddenly in probably his early 20s he started to get into drugs. So that was just a coping mechanism, and how he learned to kind of deal with the anxiety and living in a household like that. And then he got deeper and deeper into the drugs, and soon it became heroin, and then he lost his business. He had a very successful business. He lost that. So I saw him go right downhill, and it was at the height of my athletic career. So I'm trying to save him, but I'm trying to focus on my own athletic career. So you're being pulled in two directions. And that's how I really defined my life through those years, was being pulled in two directions. And then it wasn't until I left Canada that I truly lived my own life and moved away from all of that. And that was the best thing I ever did, because it allowed me to forge my own path and to move forward in my life in the best ways possible, and to ultimately get married and start a family. And, you know, I'm so lucky to have experienced those things and have had the opportunity to move abroad and to, you know, form a different life, create a different life for myself.
And I can understand why you would, and I can understand why you speak so highly of early when you spoke about your kids and your wife and moving away. It's because almost like to go back, almost Brit would bring back the trauma, in a sense. And you don't want that for your, you don't want that, we don't want to perpetuate the, you know, the continued trauma for our kids. So we bring our kids up in a different place, in a different environment, and we don't want that to carry on, that kind of, you know, generational mental health. It needs to stop in one book. You know, the children will go through things and stuff like that, but then having you as a parent who's been through the things, you will know how to help them deal with certain
things. One of the most important things with my kids was to have honest and open discussions, so they know everything that I went through, not in great detail, but they absolutely know the trauma. They know about the trauma. They know what my family went through. They never met my brothers, who passed away, either of them. They met the one who committed suicide. They had met him a couple times, but because we lived abroad, they only saw him once every couple of years. And when they were young, that's when he took his own life. So they're very familiar with the story, and we're very open about it. And I just tell them how important it is to, they need to be able to express themselves and to feel safe in expressing themselves. And that's one of the things about mental health. If you dig into people's trauma, whether they suffer from depression or anxiety, bipolar, whatever it is, everything is rooted in childhood trauma.
Yeah.
And when you dig into somebody's story, and my wife's doing a very deep course into counseling right now around childhood trauma, and it comes down to not being able to connect with your essence and not being able to express your true self to people you love.
Yeah.
And I realized that that's what I went through, and that's what most people who suffer from mental health issues, they never connected to their essence, and they weren't able to express themselves and find healthy ways to express themselves. So then they turn to coping mechanisms, the drugs, the alcohol, the other types of addictions to get them through that. And that, in a crazy way, that is what gets people through those early days.
Yeah.
And the course that my wife's doing by Dr. Gabor Maté, a Canadian psychologist who's incredible, who's written some amazing books, he says that, you know, the coping mechanisms that you develop are probably what kept you alive.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a very odd way to look at it, but then it comes to a point where those things no longer serve you, and that you have to reconnect to your essence, and you have to find meaning in your life, and you have to accept the past for what it was and learn how to express yourself in healthy ways and to be vulnerable. And vulnerability is not weakness. Vulnerability is simply speaking your truth. And through that, you reconnect with your essence and you find out who you are. So that's the greatest lessons that I can teach my boys.
You go on a journey, don't you? You go on a journey, and some people make it through that journey. For some people, you know, it could lead to, you know, suicide, or you know struggling with mental health long term. But it's about the healing process, and it's not so much of a strange thing, really, because, to be honest, when you might drink, then it might be the next thing, and you're always looking, like you say, you're always looking for something to cope. You're moving on to the next thing, and it's about finding someone or somebody to speak to along that process, or something that can get you out of that process that stops you getting to the next stage, and maybe the final stage of your journey, which is, like you say, suicide or whatever. That could be your final stage along that kind of path. And like you say, those things help you along the way. And once you get over those things, it becomes part of you and a healing process. So you took to American football. I say American football because we know it as football here in England. Your journey, in a sense, because you spoke earlier about anxiety and depression, and that wouldn't have come at the age that you are now. When did you first find out that? When was your kind of first, the first time that you realised that, oh, I wonder if this was anxiety when I was a kid, or was it a situation at home where you, as a child, where you thought, where you look back now and you think, oh, I was struggling with anxiety there, or I was struggling with depression there, or something was happening to me.
Yeah, it's, you know, when as a child, as a young person, even moving into high school, into university, you can feel that something's not right. And that's how I would describe it. You can't put your finger on it. You can't label it. Yeah. You just feel something's not right. And why am I feeling like this? And there were definitely times when I was young where I would classify it as a loneliness, kind of a dark feeling, I guess, where there was no joy, you know, and that's one of the first signs where you can't experience emotion. Yeah. You know, you might experience anger and frustration, but there's not the positive emotions that you're experiencing. So there were moments when I felt something was off. And then as I moved through my athletic career and I became more of a prominent athlete, team captain on my American football team, being more prominent, being somebody who I felt needed to be extroverted. I'm definitely introverted.
Yeah.
But I put on a facade that I was this extrovert.
Right.
And I thought that that's what I needed to do as a prominent player on the team. So there was a disconnect there. So I could only, there were times when I did feel a bit extroverted, genuinely, but oftentimes it was forced. And so going back to not being able to put your finger on it and trying to push it away, and that's, you know, that can, you can push it away easily when you're drinking and you're feeling a little better. But I think throughout my schooling into university, it was just a feeling that would pop up suddenly, and then I would have to escape.
Yeah.
And I would just have to get away from everybody because I couldn't be around people.
Yeah.
I wasn't functioning the way that I needed to around people to deeply connect, and I just needed to take my breaks. And that's when I realized, well, this is actually a good thing. So I took a lot of razzing from my teammates if I didn't go out, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I knew there were times when I just needed self-preservation, but at the time I didn't know it was self-preservation. I thought it was escapism, and you know, I was just escaping. And then I was very judgmental towards myself, like, why can't you just be in a social situation? Well, I reflect back now, and it was more self-preservation.
Yeah.
It was just my unconscious brain kicking into gear saying, you need your own space right now. You just need quiet time.
Yeah.
And I was very content being alone. You know, I found great joy in that. So then I would reconnect a couple days later, the next day, feeling refreshed.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I didn't know it was depression or anxiety, but it's classic symptoms for sure.
Yeah. And do you still find that it's, you have similar, you have similar times now where you want to, like you say, even the golf course, doing golf is, has that element of it. It's you against, they often say golf is this, it's you against the elements, man against the elements or whatever it may be. Do you still find that that's what you know, you have those thoughts that you want to be alone and, you know, fighting the elements against, you know, playing golf and things like that?
I think it comes down to my chosen routines now. Yeah. I know I just build this in. I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I usually read a chapter when I wake up and of a book that I'm reading, take notes. You know, if I've recorded a podcast, I might listen to the podcast and edit it. Whatever, I just wake up early, and that's part of my routine. That's part of what I need to do. I go for my runs. I think deeply during my runs. Golf, I play golf with my son a lot, which is great.
Yeah.
So golf is a way just to be with, you know, in nature, you know, enjoying the scenery. But I know now I purposely build in certain mechanisms and structures and habits and routines in my life that honor the things that I need in order to thrive and to move forward, you know, in positive ways.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, you know, when you were growing up and when you, you know, you start to learn about, you know, drink and understanding what's drugs and things like that, was there any, there must have been times where you had a drink or tried a drink or whatever. I'm not saying you must have had, but I'm saying becomes a rite of passage, doesn't it? Where we try a drink, but something must have pulled you away from that. Something that you said earlier, you know, I remember my upbringing, and I remember my mum getting, I remember seeing my mum drinking her with her friends drinking vodka or whatever it may be. And I don't drink, and that's the reason why, because I saw my mum going down that path, even though she's a strong woman and all, but maybe she was doing that because obviously, like I say, coping mechanism because of what she's been through and things like that, because what she'd been through was harrowing. So I was able to pull myself away from that, and even with the area where I grew up with, where there was drugs around and all sorts, prostitutes and all sorts, we as a family, we were able to pull away from that, guns and all that sort of stuff. So is that what, you know, at what point did you kind of say, did you have to pull back from doing that?
I think it was when I didn't have a lot of confidence as a student, and in order to get into university, I needed to maintain my grades.
Yeah.
In order to stay on the football team, and because football meant everything to me, I had to stay in school, and I wasn't a confident student. I never learned study habits. Studying was the last thing that I needed in high school, because I was so torn in a thousand different directions, I couldn't focus on schoolwork.
Yeah.
So I barely got through high school, and then going into university, I had no experience as a student of really applying myself and building these positive study habits, but I had no choice, because the last thing I wanted was to get kicked off the team because of poor grades and to get kicked out of school.
Yeah.
So although I would go out drinking and I would party, I knew at the end of the day that I had to maintain my grades. So I had to do whatever it took to maintain my grades.
Yeah.
And that's what helped me stay focused and not go too far down that path.
Yeah.
Although I drank and I partied, I couldn't go too far down that path. Yeah. Because I would lose a sense of myself, and then I would put my academic standing in jeopardy. So suddenly, after a couple years in university, when I was getting pretty decent grades, I was saying to myself, well, you are a capable student. You're doing something right here. So the old self-fulfilling prophecy that once you start to believe in yourself, you get more confidence, and it's a cycle, and you choose to believe in what you want to believe. So if I believed that I was a shitty student, then I would have done poorly. So I started to see that I could actually be a good student and put in the necessary time to get my degree and to play a full 5 years on the university football team, get my education degree. And so it was more of an awareness that I don't want to lose this.
Yeah,
I can't lose what I have.
Yeah.
So that forced me to focus.
Yeah.
Whereas if I didn't have sport and was just in university for the sake of being in university, I probably wouldn't have been as motivated.
Yeah. And you know, when your brothers died, you know, one, you know, aneurysm and the suicide, did you find that first time, the first brother died, and then going on to the second brother, did you find that by the time the second brother, there was less, not less of an effect, but you were able to cope with the second death more?
No, I mean, there were such tragic deaths that they impacted me greatly. So my brother, who committed suicide in 2014, suffered from major depression, and he cut everybody off in the family for the last 3 years.
Right.
So we tried to reach out to him, and I was trying to find out if he was okay. And then there was no response to emails. So, you know, we didn't talk for the last 3 years.
Right.
And suddenly I got the dreaded email from my sister giving me the news. And it was devastating. I mean, it was terrible. we flew back to Canada, and that was right before Christmas as well. So we flew back to Canada, and when I got to Canada, I had to deal with that. I talked about it in my TED Talk, how I dealt with it, but I dealt with it the day after we arrived. I knew that I needed to go for a run, and there was a snowstorm, and there was deep snow, and I just knew I needed to run.
Yeah.
So I was running through like foot deep snow, and I just kept running and running and running and running. And the strange thing is that he lived, we used to, when we went back to Canada, we used to go back to my wife's mother's house, and she was located right near the airport in Toronto. So we would stay at her house, and my brother's apartment was actually 1 kilometer away.
Right.
So even though 3 years we didn't talk, when we returned in the summer, I saw his apartment, you know, and I would try to go knock on his door, and he wouldn't answer it.
Yeah.
When I was going for a run, trying to work my way through the emotions and the grief, I didn't even want to look at his apartment. So I just ran in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And then I knew I got to come back. You know, I'd run 8 kilometers out, and I had to make the turn. And when I made the turn, after a couple kilometers going back towards my wife's mom's house, I saw his apartment building. And then I knew that I had no choice but to go to his apartment building to say goodbye to him.
Yeah.
And in that moment, as I describe in my TED Talk, is I just prayed for an understanding of why this had to happen. And I apologized to my brother for not trying harder, and I apologized to him for the pain he had to go through, and that I would never understand it, and that I kind of dedicated myself to him in that moment, to say that I'm going to do the best that I can in my life, you know, to honor you and who you were, and make sure that my sons know who you were, what you went through, and the importance of human connection and love, and you know, being honest. And so, you know, I learned through it, but it certainly wasn't easy. Nothing really prepares you for something like that.
Yeah.
You know, every death is different. Every death hits you differently.
Yeah.
But tremendous pain, and a lot of pain, and really understanding the depth to which the depth of his pain and what he went through.
Yeah.
And that's part of the journey of healing as well, though, is like figuring all of that stuff out.
Yeah. And you were able to deal with the deaths because you had a kind of a deep-rooted understanding of, so much deep of life, because even just then you said there's a thought, but you're obviously, like I say, a spiritual person, introvert, would have helped you. You've actually thought, because I'm an introvert as well, so you've actually thought on the way of running and on the way back, I've got to do this, I've got to do this, I've got to go there. And in that moment you said, you know what, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna have to go there. And then you start to speak to yourself almost retrospective and introspective. There's two folds there. And the second time, for the second, how did that, you said it affected you deeply. Obviously all deaths are different, but do you think that you were able to cope with it because of the way you were, and the next death was, you know, because we have deaths, and what happens is, and like you say, all deaths are different. I mean, I have a twin brother. My twin brother died, and subsequently, since then, I've had people who've died, and like you say, they're all different. But as a human, you're able to build a sort of strength to be able to cope with the next one, depending on who that person is, whether it's a friend or all that sort of stuff. Would you say that's kind of familiar?
Yeah, I think life offers us a wide array of learning experiences. So what is life trying to teach us? And we can shut it out, and we can block it, or we can learn from it. And I think that what really got me through was the fact that I was so dedicated to my teaching, and I knew that I had the power to impact young people.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, after my brother had died and we had his memorial service, the one who committed suicide, and we went back to China, I dove as deep as I could into my teaching
yeah.
And to deepen my craft and to become better at what I do and to make the biggest impact that I can have on my students. And then that led to on the work that I do with teachers.
Yeah.
So whenever I run a workshop, yeah, I run lots of physical education training workshops, but at the heart of it is social and emotional and mental well-being.
Yeah.
And that's how I give back, you know, and that's that those themes are never going away, you know, in my life. And those are the themes that I embed in everything that I do in my teaching, in my work with teachers, within my leadership role. And I don't let them go, and they're my center point of reference.
Yeah.
So I always figure out, how am I going to embed these themes into my work? How can I bring out the importance of social, emotional, mental, and physical well-being? And how can I help other people understand the importance of these things and plant the seeds and create the conditions for all learners to thrive in their own way, which then goes back to pedagogy and the pedagogical choices that we choose, you know, that we implement in our teaching. We've got to provide students with every possibility to find themselves and to connect to their essence and find what they love to do, and to differentiate our teaching so that every learner has an entry point.
Yeah.
Because when a learner has an entry point, then they can move forward in positive ways, and that's connected to well-being. So as I said before we started recording, it's a connecting of all of these dots.
Yeah.
And I'm still figuring it out, but I'm deeply committed to it. And
yeah.
This is what I do on an ongoing basis.
Do you think that sports, do you think being a, I'm going to say this, I'm not saying it's based on favoritism or whatever, but do you think sports gives us, as sports people, a more rounded view of teaching and, you know, students? And because the reason why I'm saying this is because a teacher will go in the classroom and teach and probably have that class for the same time, or, you know, same day every day. Whereas when you're a teacher of sports, you see a range of the children. You may see the whole school or whatever. And we often see, me, myself, I often see the children in a different to it from them being in a class. In a class, they go and sit and blah, blah, and maybe that needs to change, I don't know. But as a physical education teacher and a sports teacher and a person who is an introvert and who's been through life, and I see children in, so if the competition, if they fighting, you know, a fight, or the arguing, or tears of joy, or tears of they don't want to do PE, or whatever it may be. I want to sit down. We get that, and we see the children in all their. Do you think that we have a more insight into those children?
I think any single subject teacher does, not just PE, but PE through the experiences that we offer the kids through, you know, physical activity and sport. We definitely see them in a different light, and we see them in a variety of contexts. So we see a lot of their natural personality,
yes,
tendencies come alive,
yeah,
right?
Nuances.
But so do music teachers and
yeah,
visual arts teachers,
yeah,
in their own way too. I
yeah,
think the single subjects are amazing. The arts are amazing.
Yeah, the arts.
And I think they're equally important. And I'm an instructional coach for visual arts teachers and music teachers as well. And I've really developed a love of the arts, where although I saw the importance of it, now when I see these arts teachers, visual arts and music teachers teach, they're amazing. They love their discipline, and they're deeply dedicated to what they do. In terms of physical activity and sport, it should be a perfect lens through which to see the world and to develop our strengths. But unfortunately, an environment, and I'm not saying PE, but a sporting environment can be toxic or it can be empowering. And it all comes down to the power of the coach and the impact of the coach. And I recently had on my podcast an NFL star, a National Football League star, who talked about really the teams that he played for in the NFL. He played 8 years, really toxic environment.
Yeah. No.
Whereas some teams in the NFL have a very empowering environment that is all about bringing out the best in people and building connections and relationships. So if we rewind and we backtrack and we go to the role of the PE teacher, a PE teacher really needs to understand what their philosophy is and how they've been shaped in their own life through sport. And if they went through a sporting program that was based on control and compliance and had hard-ass coaches that were skill and drill based, you have to be really careful about the way you teach PE. Not you, but just the way that teacher teaches PE. Because they might teach in the same way they were taught and the way they were coached.
Yeah.
Therefore, they're creating a toxic environment.
Definitely.
I've seen it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
Whereas we know, based on all of the research around intrinsic motivations, I'm very into self-determination theory, which is a theory of human motivation that was developed by Dr. Richard Ryan and Dr. Edward Deci.
Yeah.
And their work for the past 50 years has clearly pointed out that humans have three fundamental needs: the need for autonomy, the need for relatedness, which is relationships, relating to others, and the need to feel competent. So when those three needs are met, then we create the conditions for people to be intrinsically motivated. So that is very, very important when it comes to the way we deliver our program. This is rooted in science and research.
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is PE should be all of those things. It should inspire kids. It should develop character. It should develop skills. It should help every student find a passion through physical activity and sport. But I've spoken to many, many students across the world when I go in and do interviews at schools, when I'm working with PE teams. And a lot of times the student feedback is wonderful about the PE program. But there are times when it's not so wonderful and the kids do not like PE.
Yeah, that's,
and it often comes back to the style of teaching.
That's interesting, because maybe I'm just thinking about me. I don't know. But when I remember going on last year and finding things to do with PE and stuff when everything was shutting down, and finding out how we can do things and connecting with PE teachers. I was reading some of the things on Twitter and stuff like that, and people were saying, "Oh, I hate PE. I hated PE when I was at school." And I knew from my past that there's people that didn't like it, but I didn't realize it was so bad that the people were actually saying that they detest PE. There's like so many people, and I understood it, because quite often it would be the consensus was, a drill sergeant, somebody who was a drill sergeant, someone who was doing this and you have to do this and you have to do that, and there was no empathy or compassion or nothing of understanding of the children themselves and getting to know the children and how they feel on a day. You know, if you don't want to do PE, what is it? Why is it today? Yes, last week you wanted to do it, but today you don't want to do it. Maybe it's something that happened at home, and it's all the back. You know, the thoughts of, okay, I'm going to leave you for a bit, and then when you're ready, you can join in, and things like that. So, you're right. It's about who the teacher is, who the PE teacher is, who the who's the sports coach, and it's important that we get that right. And like you said, the arts, because I'm My first love, well, my two loves was arts, because I'm a graphic designer, and sports. So I've done both. So my brain is that way wired to do sports and arts and working with, because I go to museums and look at the arts and things like that. So I'm very much interested in psychology and kind of deep-rooted things to do with life. What would you say, you know, because we can bring the podcast to a close, what would you say to somebody that may be struggling with mental health, that you want to send a message to them and that may have gone through similar things to you and maybe going through things now?
I would say to find some quiet time to journal, and journal in a way that I think it's important to put thoughts down on paper and just begin to create some questions of curiosity about your own life and some of the thoughts that you're having or some of the questions, whatever the questions are, but start to write down some questions about yourself and why, if you're in a moment where, not a moment, but if you're struggling, begin to ask some questions about why and start to dig into those questions with curiosity. Not judgment, curiosity. And begin to connect with some other people who you know might have gone through the same thing or are going through the same thing. But through this kind of like a mining, you're mining into your own life, and you're trying to figure out some important things about yourself, but be open to learning more about yourself. And as painful as it can be a little more open to explore the past and to understand a little more about the past and to stay open to that. And a lot of people don't want to reach out. I have somebody I connected with. So I do some coaching on the side, not sport coaching, but life coaching.
Yeah.
So I came across somebody who reached out to me a few years ago. And this person is an incredibly talented artist. And they were really struggling. And they've been through a lot. And they were very introverted and feared reaching out to anybody. And I told them, instead of reaching out to somebody, just begin to reach inside and to better learn about yourself and to accept your past and not be judgmental, but to learn more about it. And recently, so that was a couple of years ago, and we were in touch back and forth a number of times, and then I didn't hear from them for a couple of years, and they reached out to me again a couple of weeks ago, and they're really struggling again. So I encourage them, you have to reach out to somebody and you have to talk to somebody about this, but they're so afraid.
Yeah.
And it can be a very scary thing, but when whoever is listening to this who might be struggling, start with yourself, try to better understand yourself, try to journal, and when you're ready, truly reach out to somebody and seek their wisdom and insight and connect with those. Surround yourself with people who you know will buoy you up,
yeah,
and lift you up, and remove yourself from people who pull you down and make you feel like shit, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, so surround yourself with people that are going to buoy you up.
Yeah.
So I would say those things. I hope I gave some little insights there, but journaling, connection with others, and surround yourself with excellence.
Yeah. And what inspires you? And what are some of the things that you do? Yes, that you say you play golf. Do you watch football? Do you still watch football? Do you play it? What are some of the things about you? You know, we've gone through your journey, and what are these things about you? What makes you you now? What makes you fascinating, unique person? That's you.
Yeah, I've learned that, you know, my love of reading, rather than getting new book after new book, go back to the books that have meant a ton to me, books that have really impacted me. I actually have one of them right here. It's called Grit. I don't know if you've ever come across this, by Dr. Angela Duckworth.
Yeah.
But it's all about the power of passion and perseverance. So what I've done is I've developed this habit that I love, this routine, where I have the audio book as well.
Yeah.
So I will speed up the audiobook to like 1.25. So it's not a normal pace, it's just slightly faster.
Yeah.
And then I go through the book as I'm listening to it, and I just highlight passages that are important to me. Passages that resonate with me and my mental health, passages that resonate with emotional health, with research, how to impact students more. And then I can usually get done a book in about a week.
Yeah.
And then for the next week, I take notes. So I have a Google Doc where I have all of the research that I'm reading, powerful stories that I've read about, ideas that I've read about. So I create this bank of excellence.
Yeah.
And that has been something that has been just fantastic, a fantastic process for me. So that's something kind of unique that I've stumbled across in the past few months that is really a part of my daily routine. So that's something that really works for me, and that's new. Before, I would just read.
Yeah.
Try to read as much as I can, then I throw it on the shelf and I get the next book. I order the next book on Amazon and I plow through that. Then I get the next book and I get the next book. So I'm giving up the rat race of reading.
Yeah.
And really going back to what's most important, and really trying to capture the essence of that and to document it.
Yeah.
So that, because it'll come in handy one day.
Yeah.
In some shape or form.
Yeah, so that's what we do with life, don't we? We go through life and we pick out, and a lot of the things don't resonate, and then we pick out, remember, or we pick out the things that mean a lot to us, or the people that mean a lot to us. Do you feel now then, do you feel you've healed, and do you feel now that your brothers are looking down at you, and your healing process is kind of still carrying on, and do you feel that you've gone so far in a sense of helping, you know, the promise that you made to them, the promise you made, do you feel that you're fulfilling that?
100%. I believe that one is never healed, but it's a constant healing journey, and it's an ongoing story, and our ongoing personal narrative is hugely important to understand and continue to construct as we go through life.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
No.
You know, so tomorrow is a new day. And somebody who I really admire, a mentor of mine, has a life philosophy that every day is an opportunity to create a living masterpiece.
Yeah.
That's the philosophy that he lives by. And that's how I look at my own life and what's possible, is that every day is an opportunity to create a living masterpiece, and whatever that is. If it's making me better as a teacher, as a leader, as a father, as a husband, if it's making me feel mentally stronger, more healthy mentally, emotionally,
yeah,
physically, this is all part of an ongoing kind of healing journey that never ends.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I feel that I have honored my brothers, and the first step was actually giving that TED talk and really sharing their story and what we went through as a family, and the dedication that I have to the education profession.
Yeah. And just before we go, and get you to let people know, you know, where you could be found if you want to be found, and where people can hear, you know, your TED talks and things like that. When you did that TED talk, and I'm going to, because I have a kind of a feeling, when you did that TED talk, how did it feel to kind of say what you said, to let it all out? And did you feel like, yes, I've, because from where you come, we often have these things, don't we? From where we come from these beginnings, trauma and all that sort of stuff, and childhood, and then and it's almost like becomes an achievement. How did that feel for you on that day? Did you kind of like, yes, I did it?
Yeah, it was a rewarding process, but it was daunting.
Yeah.
Because you're preparing for the process, and anybody who's done a TED Talk, you go through a very strict process, which is you have to meet the TED committee, the organizing committee,
right,
to share what your talk is going to be about.
Yeah.
Then you have to meet them and do a first draft, and then you have to meet them again and do the full version of the talk, and they're bombarding you with critical feedback the whole time.
Yeah. Wow.
And the critical feedback is necessary to improve your talk. The talk can be no longer than 18 minutes. My talk was 29 minutes, 30 minutes, so I had to cut out what I thought was critically important parts, but I had to filter it down to the main message that I wanted to deliver. And then, yeah, a few people knew that I was going to give the talk, but they didn't know what it was going to be about. And then I got quite scared about a week before I was going for a run, and I was like, shit, there's no way I can get on that stage and bear this. I can't share this. And I got kind of scared, and I thought, well, I've given so many talks in different places. I've got different talks on my computer. I'll just pull something up and I'll tell the TED committee I'm going to change the talk. And then when I got back after my run, I said to myself, no, you won't. You will dishonor your brothers by doing this. So I needed to really take advantage of the opportunity that was my moment to share my authentic self and the story. So I got up and I did the talk, and I was grateful for the opportunity. And then when it was over, I was the last speaker of the day. I remember this clearly. When I was walking up the steps, as I was exiting the theater, the president of our university, COUST is a huge organization, the president of the university was standing there, and he pulled me aside and he told me what an incredibly important talk that was to give. And he said, as a president of other universities around the world, we've always had to deal with mental health and student suicide, and you sharing that talk is very, very important. So that was kind of the first moment where I thought, oh, wow, okay, maybe it did impact at least one person. And then when I walked out of the auditorium, some people were talking to me, and then this guy walked past me and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, that was excellent, thank you. And a day later, he emailed me, and he was a visiting researcher, lecturer, who is a world-renowned climate expert. And he emailed me the next day to say, I was the one that tapped you on the shoulder. I didn't want to interrupt. You were talking to some people, and I want you to know that I was your story, and that I was a cocaine addict, and I almost committed suicide, and then I found ultramarathon running.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your story. And I was like, shit, okay, maybe that's two people, you know? So there was a lot of comments after that and emails that I received from people. And then when the TED Talk went on YouTube, it hasn't been seen that many times. I think it's been viewed just over 5,000 times. But I've received emails from people who've seen it and have thanked me for it. So I think when you give yourself permission to open up and share your truth, you give permission to other people to do the same.
Yeah, you do.
And I think that's what I've learned through it. And that gave me the confidence to be a little more open about my experiences, with the best interest at heart of truly helping people.
Yeah, definitely. And where can you be found? I found you on social media. I said I found you. It was like I'm searching, searching the web. Where can you be found? If anybody wants to contact you, or are you on LinkedIn? Let people know.
Yeah. So I'm on LinkedIn. My name, Andy Vasily. I have my own podcast that's called the Run Your Life Podcast. I've done, I think, about 165 episodes. I'm just redesigning the website for that. So I interview Olympians and professional athletes and best-selling authors. And I love embedding these themes of mental health into everything that I talk about with my guests and their journeys. And I'm on Twitter at Andy Vasily and Instagram at Andy Vasily.
Yeah. And I'd like to say thank you for coming on. Fantastic story, fascinating story as well. And you're obviously an inspiration. You've been around the world. You've obviously taught and worked with children, young people, even adults, and you continue to do so. So I'd like to say thank you for coming on the podcast. And we didn't know each other before, and it was an opportunity to speak to you and kind of find out about your journey, because I don't know anything about you, and this is a learning journey for me. So thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Andrew, and good luck with your podcast, and keep doing what you're doing. And I think it's an important topic, and just continue doing what you're doing, and lots of people will benefit from it. So thank you for having me on.
And that was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.